Welcome to PharmaTalk Radio. I'm Kimberly Chin, Marketing Director of the Mobile and Clinical Trials Program. PharmaTalk Radio is a nonprofit program to disseminate helpful information to the life science and patient advocacy communities. Today's radio program is a session focused on CTTI's Mobile and Clinical Trials Program, which propose recommendations that would help clarify the pathway for developing novel endpoints for use in clinical trials from data generated using mobile technology.
It's a nice little step back here, I guess. I'm not as tall as people think I am. Don't want to topple off. Well, terrific, Dan. Thanks so much for that introduction. And I'm delighted to be here today to present on behalf of our city team. And I think it's important to stress that while I'm here today, this was certainly a pretty extraordinary team effort by a multi-stakeholder, a group of experts. So I want to sort of begin by thanking them for all of their hard work that got us here. So for folks who don't know, our organization, City, we are a public-private partnership, and we were co-founded by Duke and FDA. And we're also very proudly a member organization, and we have over 80 member organizations now that run the gamut from sort of large pharmaceutical companies, biotechs, device companies. We also have patient advocates, individual patient advocates and patient groups, IRBs, academic organizations. Increasingly, we're welcoming more technology companies, which we're very proud of, and I think reflects a bit of a seed change in where the entire clinical trials enterprise is going. And our mission is to develop and drive the adoption of practices that increase the quality and efficiency of clinical trials. And the way that we try and address that mission is we, you know, rather than try and sort of boil the ocean, is that we work on a project-by-project basis. And we try and identify issues that are sort of common pain points for different stakeholder groups across the industry. What are issues that are sort of facing and challenging many groups within the industry? And we get wonderful feedback, not just from our regulatory colleagues, but also our member organizations on what those topics should be. And sort of interestingly enough, it was our FDA colleagues who came to us and really encouraged us to take on the mobile work that we're doing right now at City. And so definitely sort of kudos to them for being, I think, very forward-thinking and pressing us to take that on. And then when we floated the idea to our member organizations, they were absolutely delighted sort of across the board. I think that they recognized that there was huge opportunity with using mobile in trials, but it was quite unclear how to move that forward. And so to that end, it very quickly sort of became apparent to us as an organization that trying to do all this work using a single project really wouldn't be that effective. It would be too long or too unwieldy. There's far too much to address. So we wound up actually creating four projects. But before I go into those, we also wrapped a couple more sort of we defined our scope in other ways too. We wanted to really focus on FDA-regulated clinical trials. I think what's wonderful is that we've seen a large number of these devices being used in sort of clinical studies and sort of academic settings, feasibility testing. But what we really wanted to do was to try and push things forward. And again, you know, bear in mind, this issue was sort of brought to us by FDA, that there was, despite, I think, the consensus, there's this huge promise for quality and efficiency gains using mobile. There's still this paucity of these technologies in regulatory trials. And so specifically, that's what we wanted to address. What we also realized is, you know, again, sort of mHealth or digital, you know, incredibly broad term. And we recognize that technology certainly has the ability, I think, to improve quality, improve efficiency at the point of recruitment. We talked a lot in the last session about consent, about retention, but where, and even, you know, technologies as the intervention themselves. We're starting to see that come through too. But what we really wanted to think about was the technology as either a way to sort of capture data and or as a sort of operational support, so telemedicine, for example. So that was the area of our focus, and once we sort of narrowed that down, we passed our efforts out into four different projects, one looking specifically at legal and regulatory issues, another looking at the development or the selection and the development of technology-derived novel endpoints, and that's what I'll talk about today. A project that's very closely aligned with that is our work on mobile devices. And specifically, that device project, I think, dovetails with the endpoints work It really tries to support, well, once you've sort of developed an endpoint, how do you design the protocol appropriately and how do you select the right device and all of those sorts of questions? And then another on stakeholder perceptions, which I think, you know, again, based on the previous panel, I think is a critically important issue. So before I dive into the findings and talk to you about the recommendations we have for sort of developing these endpoints ready for use in a registrational trial, I wanted to just pause for a second and share a little bit of information that the project team did as part of a systematic review of the literature. And what we did was between 2010 and 16, we looked at all published studies. So, you know, bear in mind, that's not capturing everything. There's an extraordinary amount of work that goes on within industry that perhaps may not be published, where technology-derived endpoints were actually used to answer a scientific question. So they were either the primary, the secondary, or the safety endpoint in a study where all of the data was captured outside of the clinic. So interestingly, over that sort of 5.5-year period, we went to sort of midway through 2016, we found 88 studies. So what was interesting as we were sort of, you know, winnowing down that list and doing sort of abstract review is that we excluded, this is not an overstatement, I would say close to 1,000 feasibility studies. So it's certainly not that there isn't an extraordinary amount of work going on, but when we actually look at sort of where have these studies evolved to the point where you're trying to answer the question exclusively using this technology, this still seems a little green. What's interesting, and we sort of sliced and diced this many different ways, and you know, our hope is that this will be published this fall, and there'll be much more information there. But I did just want to sort of show, you know, one, that we're at under 100 publications that have actually tried to use these technologies to answer a question, and also the breakdown across therapeutic areas. So just very quickly here, and then we'll get into the meat of things. When we set out as a project team to create these recommendations and tools, we really wanted to come up with best practices for selecting, developing, and including these technology-derived endpoints in clinical trials. And I think a sort of important place, just to pause briefly, is to say when we talk about novel endpoints, we're talking about two things. Firstly, sort of brand new assessments that it's previously been sort of impossible to capture using traditional methods, but also new and, you know, hopefully better ways of capturing existing measures using technologies specifically out in sort of free living conditions. And what we came up with as a project team is not only some recommendations, but I think a really comprehensive suite of products to help support the implementation of these recommendations and really help drive forward the development of these technology-derived endpoints. So what I'll do is I'll run through, just give a sort of high-level overview for you of the different tools we came up with, and then take a bit of a deeper dive into the recommendations and specifically the development pathway. And it was really interesting listening to the previous panel. One of the things, and I'm looking at our industry team lead, Rob DiCicco from GSK, who really encouraged us to think critically about some of those cultural issues in the work that we did. And sort of, you know, it doesn't matter if we can clarify the process and if it's sort of crystal clear, but if you can't get buy-in from the decision makers to sort of fund and support the efforts, it's all academic. So one of the things we came up with was a benefit framework. And really that fell into three different categories. We see benefits in efficacy, in efficiency, and in patient centricity when you start to develop these technologies. And we pass that out into short, medium, and long-term benefits. And we hope that that's an important tool for folks who are excited about this, who do have a plan for creating these measures, but have to sort of, you know, roll it up the chain a little bit to get that buy-in, to get that support. So there's that tool that we hope will do that. There's another one, a selection tool to support decisions between possible endpoints that you might be looking at developing. One of the things that became apparent in the work that we did on this is, you know, while we're very excited to have clarified the process and we do think it's very manageable and we do think really we are in a position now to start driving this work forward, you know, no one's going to develop 5 at once, right? And, you know, especially early on, you're going to have to be discerning, you're wanting to be looking for success. You may also want to be, you know, some of the other comments that we were talking about, you want to be sort of really targeting your efforts so perhaps you can transfer things to other therapeutic areas so that you might be targeting at patient populations or disease states where you can unburden patient populations that really struggle to participate, for example. And so there's this interactive selection tool where if you have a couple of ideas, if you're sort of trying to identify the one measure that you want to develop first and where you want to devote your resources, we hope that that would be a useful tool. And then importantly, we actually put together a reference guide to interacting with FDA. One of the things during our work, and it was funny that Dan said that there were some heated discussions during some of the meetings and some of the work groups that led to the development of these recommendations, there was my impression, personal impression, is that there's a real sort of fear of these measures, that the FDA seems really intimidating. And it's funny, we're certainly at Citi very spoilt with the nature of our relationship with the regulators. We are a public-private partnership. You know, but to me, I know that the regulators brought this problem to us. They said, we want to see more of it. We recognize that there are gains to be made here. We are confused as to why there's a paucity of these technologies being used in trials. Help us find out. And interestingly, as we were putting this guide together, even I sort of was educated about the myriad different ways that already exist that you can go and contact, you know, CEDA and CDRH to talk to them, you know, about developing these things and also to get guidance and to get support. And so, you know, we put that together and we encourage folks to use that. And certainly our experience, and this is, you know, just me talking, but our experience is that the regulators are very receptive, and there are certainly many mechanisms to having that conversation. And we certainly sort of, you know, as we'll see in the recommendations, recommend talking to regulators throughout the process. One of the things I will share sort of a bit later is some details on, you know, the flowchart and the detailed description of the development process. I think we can come up with overarching recommendations, but the question still remains, okay, but what do we have to do? And so that's what those two tools sort of really come up with. And as I said, I'll take a dive into that in a moment. The other thing that we were really proud of as a project team to push out were some use cases. And really specifically, you know, again, we go back to, you know, we feel like we've come up with a process, we've come up with a detailed description, but when it's all sort of theoretical, it's a little bit hard to wrap your head around. So we worked through these use cases because we really wanted to give examples of, you know, how this process might work out in different therapeutic areas. But also, what's interesting, I think, when you look at the four different use cases, there's different unmet need for new measures in these four different disease states. And also, there's different sort of quality of existing, you know, quote-unquote gold standard measures. And so, you know, as Dan sort of mentioned in his introduction, you know, if you're trying to develop a measure that's better than what currently exists, you know, and you're trying to sort of, I think the default setting going into this was, well, if you want to develop a new measure, you just tether it to the old one, and then you tell them it works, and then it's great, and then you move on. But the question is, and I'll use the example of the Duchenne's muscular dystrophy case, you know, again, I sort of received an education in this process, and as much as, you know, 6-minute walk test, which in and of itself, I think we'll all agree, has some flaws, but that's the gold standard measurement for Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. And I was, you know, frankly horrified to hear that the vast majority of the boys and young men who suffer with muscular dystrophy are in a wheelchair and are simply unable to participate in the one measure that exists for this disease. So, you know, what do you want to do? Develop a new measure that tethers to the 6-minute walk test? Absolutely not. You want to be sort of more innovative. You want to address the unmet need for a measure that's suitable for, you know, what the patients are telling us. And so, you know, that was really interesting. We started to look at upper limb mobility because we heard loud and clear from patients and from their carers that they wanted to have independence. Well, what does that independence look like? It's texting, it's playing video games with your friend, it's doing your homework, it's feeding yourself, right? It's nothing to do with a 6-minute walk test. And so, you know, we were really excited by the possibilities. And, you know, when I talk through the process, I'll shed a little bit more light on sort of how some of these decisions tie into the process. So I think I've sort of addressed along the way some of the recommendations that sort of overarch the process. Focus on those measures that are meaningful to patients. I think that, you know, one of the things, again, from the previous panel is that you don't want the sort of the tail to wag the dog. You don't want to start with the technology and then try to sort of back into a measure. You want to start with what's the unmet need for a quality measure, and then can a technology help you address that unmet need? So, you know, what cascades from that is select the device after selecting the outcome assessment. And use a systematic approach to identify key novel endpoints. As we said, we're really optimistic about this process. We think it's ready for prime time. We think it's very feasible. It's not going to happen overnight, though. There's going to be investment and there's going to be time that's required. So you want to make sure you get off on the right foot. You systematically select the correct endpoint for your needs. One of the other things that shone through, and I think this ties back to sort of the work involved, but, you know, there has to be collaboration among stakeholders. And so it's not just, as we sort of say in the next recommendation, engaging the regulators, although that's important, but it's engaging patients and clinician experts and saying, what's the unmet need for a measure in your field? It's getting the technology companies involved early so they understand the problem you're trying to solve for with the technology, so they can try and meet the needs that you have with their technologies, and they can participate in the development of this work. Creating technical standards. This is, you know, was beyond the scope of the work we did to create the standards themselves, but just to give you some sort of anecdotal numbers from that systematic review we did. So there are 88 studies. Some of them were throwing in 3-4 sort of technology-derived endpoints in some cases. I forget the exact number, but I am absolutely not overstating it to say that we had over 50 different ways that you could measure activity. Whether that was, you know, you were looking at exercise intensity as opposed to capacity, but it was also like, even if you were looking at capacity, it was like percentage of participants who met the WHO guidelines for activity, or number of steps a day, or number of steps an hour. And you just think to yourself, well, in the absence of these standards, we are never going to be able to do any meta-analysis. We're never going to be able to compare anything. And I think that rolls down to the algorithms too. I understand, and the team certainly educated me, you know, I'm like, well, share them all. And they're like, well, calm down. And, you know, there is IP associated with the algorithms, but there needs to be transparency in how you got there. We need to be able to understand if we're comparing apples and apples or apples and oranges. So the need for standards in the measures, for transparency at the very least across the algorithms, so you can have certainty about what you're looking at, I think is really important. One of the other things, and I think this was brought up earlier, is include these novel endpoints as exploratory endpoints. Again, sort of going back to the work that we saw in the published literature, these many, many hundreds of feasibility studies, and honestly, I supported our social science team, I read a lot of these abstracts. I might have read the same thing 10 times just this morning. You know, the idea that there's this, you know, it sounds terrible, but there's this redundant work going on. And the idea that there's sort of a feasibility study after another, you know, what we would encourage folks is to sort of be bold and to start including these as exploratory endpoints in other studies, really start to understand them. Also in observational cohort studies, and again, I think what I learned is the importance that I think patient groups can play here. They will certainly know the measures that are most important to them, and they have engaged groups of patients who, from what I understand, are very willing to sort of provide the natural history of these measures that's going to be critical to developing these technology-derived endpoints. And finally, we encourage folks to critically position novel endpoints in interventional trials. One of the things that was interesting to us, especially working through the use cases, is this idea that, you know, well, you're going to come up with this one measure and it's going to be a silver bullet. It's going to be your single primary endpoint and you're going to hang everything off it. It's an extraordinary amount of pressure, and sometimes it's simply not necessary. And I'll, you know, the example of heart failure, I think, is a really wonderful one. I think that we would be foolish to think we're going to topple, you know, cardiac hospitalization or mortality anytime soon in terms of your gold standard endpoints. But what I learned from the heart failure patients we worked with is that, you know, some of them have been enrolled in several studies, and they tell me that's 10 years of their life. There's a long time to get that information. And, you know, while they're certainly trying to avoid, and I don't mean to be flippant, but certainly trying to avoid hospitalization and death, what I learned was that they want to be able to make it from the car to the house with their grocery bags, right, and not feel out of breath or participate with their grandchildren. And so, you know, there are these other measures, richer measures, and sometimes you might want to put it as your primary endpoint. Duchenne's muscular dystrophy is a great example. But other times it's going to be more providing additional color, additional information to support existing measures that, you know, are perfectly sufficient. So, you know, for us, being discerning about how you position that endpoint in a study can really help you sort of tee yourself up for success. So I apologize. I've done a horrible job with my timing, so I'm going to whiz through this in about a minute, but I'm happy to spend any time later sort of chatting to folks about this process. I think at a high level, I would say a couple things. First of all, the initial steps, 1 through 6, it really starts at this high level with, you know, what's the problem you're trying to solve for? What's the unmet need? What are patients and clinicians telling you that needs to happen? You start to winnow it down. So, for example, if it's the ability to move and exercise in heart failure, then you think about, is it capacity of movement or quality? Then how are you going to measure that capacity? But those steps, we really encourage you to do sort of in the order that we recommend, with device selection coming later. Then the standards are critically important. Something that jumps out at me with this is the white box. It's really interesting. This, to us, is the one dogleg or decision point, for want of a different expression. You identify your unmet need, you say we need a new measure, and then you ask yourself, can technology help me solve this problem? And if your answer is yes, you need to select your device, you need to set your standards, but then you return to the process that's exactly the same process we've always used in developing every outcome measure that's used in every clinical study right now. For anyone who's participated in helping develop a PRO, the steps you look at are the same. You need to develop your body of evidence. You need to decide how the measures are going to be taken. What's clinically meaningful? What does change look like? Do you have floor and ceiling effects? That's all in here. This is all on the website. But that really stood out to us, that there are essentially only 2 extra steps that differ from all of the work that has traditionally been done. And to us, I think that was really important. We want this to be less intimidating for folks. It's certainly not an easy process. It's going to require pre-competitive collaboration, the establishment of a lot of data. But we're really excited about it. And also, as I said, I don't think that process is that different to what we really have, you know, frankly, got down to an art in this industry in terms of developing other measures. So, as I said, we're really optimistic. The rest of the recommendations and tools in full are on our website. Dan, I've been horrible and probably have no time for questions to keep you on schedule, but I'm happy to chat to anyone at the break if that's useful. So thank you so much.
For more information about the annual Mobile and Clinical Trials Program, taking place September 24th, 2018 in Boston, visit theconferenceforum.org. Thanks for listening.